This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Should reporters be forced to reveal confidential sources? Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. All over the country, more and more prosecutors and judges are demanding that reporters break their promises to anonymous sources. Congress is considering a new law to protect what's called the free flow of information in federal courts. Opponents say that will encourage news stories that libel innocent citizens or create risks to national security. On To the Point, why do sources demand anonymity? What will be lost if they have to come out of the closet? Who should decide what the public has a right to know? On Reporter's Notebook later on the fourth anniversary of Guantanamo Bay's detention facility, continuing controversy. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Olney back with To the Point. Weeks after Judith Miller got out of prison, the argument over confidential news sources continues on Capitol Hill. On To the Point, should reporters and their sources be shielded in federal court or subject to the same legal requirements as everyone else? On Reporter's Notebook, on the fourth anniversary of the prison at Guantanamo Bay, new military tribunals, and reports of continuing torture. First, this news update. Residents of New Orleans will have 4 months to either prove they can bring their neighborhoods back to life or sell their property. That's according to the Bring New Orleans Back Commission, which reported today to Mayor Ray Nagin. Dan Shea is managing editor of the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, and we should tell you that he is joining us from his FEMA trailer, which is out in front of his house, a home which was partially destroyed in the Katrina disaster. Thanks very much, Dan Shea, for being with us.
Thank you. Good to hear from you, Warren.
What does all of this mean? What are people supposed to do in 4 months to demonstrate they can bring their neighborhoods back to life?
That is still the question left undone. What will be the criteria? What the commission is proposing is within 13 separate districts within the city, a group is put together, including neighborhood activists and professional planning consultants and local elected politicians, who are basically going to do a gut check and try to determine whether the residents of that area are indeed returning. The city's population is a shadow of what it once was. We estimate it now at about 144,000 compared to a pre-Katrina total of 462. New Orleans is a vast metropolitan area, and the big fear is if you don't have some planning process that people will come back helter-skelter. You might be living in your renovated house, and for miles around you are destroyed houses or empty lots. The process, which is heavy with politics and emotion, is trying to slowly shrink the area to match the number of people.
So that's really the basic issue then. How big is New Orleans going to be?
Correct.
Again, you say that it's uncertain at this point as of what the criteria might be. What about the commission? And does this recommendation that if you can't bring your neighborhood back or prove that you can in 4 months, you got to sell out, does that have authority of law?
The structure that they would do that is both through a new agency with the ability to for eminent domain, the Crescent City Redevelopment Corporation, the Louisiana Recovery Authority, which is the state's vehicle, also has that power and ultimately controls the federal purse strings. This is not a plan to shrink the city. This is a plan to take another closer look with wider community involvement and allow time for people to essentially vote with their feet. But at the end of the day, two-thirds of the $18 billion that this plan is estimated to cost would go to home buyout.
Talking to Dan Shea, once again managing editor for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, outside in his FEMA trailer. I have to ask you in this context, what about your own neighborhood? Do you think you can demonstrate in 4 months that it's worth rebuilding?
I'm actually in suburban Jefferson Parish. It was one of the few areas outside of New Orleans also flooded by the 17th Street Canal. We back up to it. Jefferson is a different situation where much of the land is dry, and the area came back very, very quickly. You'll hear Perhaps you hear the sound of saws and hammerings and compressors. So it's a good sound to hear in New Orleans these days. I wish we could hear it in more areas, but often you just see nothing and hear silence as you drive through these areas.
Back then to New Orleans itself, the mayor, of course, has been running around the country encouraging people to come back. Now they come back and they have to be told that they have more to do, that they have to demonstrate to him whether or not their neighborhoods are viable. Where does that put him politically?
Well, he is in the ultimate hot seat, and I should add that right in the middle of this process, these neighborhood plans are supposed to be produced by May 20th and have a decision. In the middle of that, we're going to have the first round of mayoral and council primaries. So there are so many unanswered questions, including politically, and will there be a new mayor at the end of this to supervise this?
Does he have challengers? Have they come out of the woodwork?
The formal challengers have been few so far, but everybody is looking at it, and it's a measure in which just how wide the support will be. How much absentee voting will you have from our exile community? More than half of the residents, probably up to 60% of the residents of the city of New Orleans, do not live here. Nothing can go forward until you determine whether they're coming back. When you mentioned that he's urging them to come back, right now they can't. Vast stretches of the city still do not have adequate public services, safe streets, power, certainly power into homes or any place to live. We're still struggling to get trailer communities up, which is really the only alternative for people who just want to put their feet down and give it a go.
And we heard yesterday on this program the sad story of people who are in hotels in New Orleans who are being kicked out so that people can come who have reservations for the Mardi Gras. Well, there are also the state and the federal governments involved. Will they necessarily go along with whatever the city decides?
They don't have to go along, but they have to be consulted. In the end, they hold the purse strings. Almost all the money will be funneled from the federal government through the state. So today, there'll be a briefing for state officials. They have been in contact with Don Powell, who's the president's representative, the reconstruction czar, as we call him. Everyone will have to buy in, and a key element of this is congressional approval of the so-called Baker Bill, which will provide about half the money for the buyouts we need.
Dan Shea, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Good luck to you particularly. President Bush apparently is going to visit New Orleans tomorrow. In a moment, should reporters be forced to reveal their confidential sources? On To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're only back with To The Point. Many news stories depend on confidential sources. They provide reporters with information only if they're promised they won't be identified. In 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the First Amendment does not protect the reporter's promise of anonymity in federal cases. For the past 30 years, prosecutors have been somewhat reluctant to pursue reporters unless there's no other way to obtain information they need. But that appears to be changing. That's according to Rachel Smolkin, managing editor of the American Journalism Review, in an article called Under Fire. Rachel Smolkin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
First of all, how important are confidential sources?
Well, they're very important if used correctly. I think this the answer to this has two parts. The first part is that journalists really do need to be able to use confidential sources. They're most important, most classically, of course, in the Watergate case and the use of Deep Throat to guide the reporters to the story, but also of critical importance in many intelligence and national security investigative pieces, very appropriate, where you're just not going to get the information unless you use confidential sources. And on a local level, very important also in stories that show perhaps wrongdoing, corruption in City Hall, police brutality, where you really do need confidential sources many times. If somebody is talking about wrongdoing on the part of their boss, for example, they're not likely to let you use their name. Perhaps they're telling you a story where their boss at City Hall has made an improper deal with a contractor who has some work before the city. Those are classic cases where you would rely on anonymous sources. The other side of this debate that's getting some attention within the media right now is that the confidential sources have become very overused. You see them, for example, all the time in political stories. People who maybe don't need anonymity are hiding behind it to say negative things about their opponents or about the other side. So at the same time, we're seeing this assault on anonymous sources and journalist protection of these sources in the courts. The media is having its own discussion about cracking down on the widespread use and using them only when most appropriate.
Tell us about this assault, as you refer to it, in the courts.
Well, what we're seeing now, and different people have interpreted it variously as a trend or not a trend, depending on your point of view, but what we are definitely seeing is a number of very high-profile cases, particularly in federal courts where the protections for journalists are not as they're not as much as in many state courts. We're seeing, of course, the Valerie Plame investigation, where the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, has successfully leaned on a number of journalists to get their sources. Some of the journalists felt that it was their responsibility to aid in this national security investigation, which is, of course, looking at who outed the CIA agent Valerie Plame. So that's a very high-profile case with many wrinkles to it, a very complex case that's gotten a lot of attention. There are a number of other cases going on right now, among them the Wenho Lee case, which is a civil suit brought by a former nuclear physicist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. He, of course, was under investigation for espionage and pled guilty to a single count of mishandling information and now wants to know who spread this misinformation about him, who spread information that he didn't think should be out there. So he is suing under the Privacy Act he's suing the government and attempting to find out who told the reporters these things about him.
So we have the Privacy Act. We also have, in the case of Valerie Plame and others as well, issues of national security involved.
That's right. And, of course, what we're seeing now are what looks like the beginnings of yet another very important national security investigation, the New York Times, with its critically important December 16th scoop about the secret national security agency program authorized by President Bush to eavesdrop on Americans without a warrant. And, of course, the Justice Department has launched a probe to find out who leaked this classified information to reporters. Now, that's early, very early in its going, so we don't know what will happen, but, of course, it's possible we could see some subpoenas to reporters in that case as well.
Rachel Smolkin, again, managing editor of the American Journalism Review. Walter Pincus is a reporter at The Washington Post, reports often on national security. He has, in fact, been subpoenaed in both the Valerie Plame case and the Wenho Lee case. Walter Pincus, welcome to you.
Nice to be here, Warren.
Why do sources demand confidentiality?
Well, it depends on who the sources are and what they're saying or what you're asking them, but most of them, in my case, are people who work in the national security field and are talking about things they shouldn't talk about that are either classified or perhaps embarrassing to the government, and they're the people we depend on to find out what's going on beyond what the government says publicly.
What about the issue of national security? To what extent are you treading on the possibility of revealing things that will endanger the nation because they've been revealed?
You're always very conscious of that. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I was in the government in counterintelligence in the Army, and I twice ran investigations in the Senate for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee under Senator Fulbright and dealt with classified information throughout all this period. So I feel I'm fairly sensitive to determining when something really does endanger national security and when it doesn't. And one of the problems over the 30 years has always been over-classification.
Are all reporters, do you think, in a position to make that kind of decision? Are they the ones who ought to decide what the public has a right to know?
Well, in the first instance, I think you have to face the fact that we're not the ones who broke security. We're not stealing the information. People who have access to it are either giving it to us or telling us. So the breakdown really doesn't come with us. It comes with the people who have received the information themselves. We're kind of secondary to that, and the Post has a whole history, as do other publications, of when we do believe there's a possibility that we're hurting national security, or when we're checking the information. You've got to remember that people don't, if you're a reasonable reporter, somebody doesn't give you something, tell you it's classified, and you put it in the paper. There is a reporting function that goes along with all of this, and depending on how you perform, what your responsibility is as a journalist, you generally do some reporting about any kind of information you get to see if it's true. And in that process, you, when it comes to classified information, you almost always talk to the government so they have an understanding of what you got.
So you don't then, simply based on one confidential source, publish something without trying to do some kind of checking, perhaps even with the various agents, the very agency that classified the information in the first place?
Well, often you start out with the agency in the first place, because you've got to find out whether the document that's given you and said to be classified is legitimate.
Earlier, Rachel Smilkin talked about all the stories that have depended on confidential sources in the past. Do you believe, Walter Pincus, that if there is what she referred to as an assault on confidential sources in the courts, it's going to dry up your sources?
Well, it depends on what happened. My experience in both the Plame case and the Wen-Ho-Li case, both pending, is that in neither case did I give up a source. In the Plame case, my source came forward to the prosecutor, told his story, said he was the one who gave me the information, and then released me to confirm, in effect, deal with the prosecutor about what was said. But as part of that deal, I was not to name him publicly, and I never have.
With regard to the Wen-Ho-Li case, Rachel Smilkin pointed out that that involved a physicist at Los Alamos. It was reported that he was under investigation for espionage. He ended up pleading to a much lesser charge, and there were apologies from the government. To what extent do reporters get used by sources to damage somebody? If I don't know that that happened in this case, but if it's not an example of that, are there others that where that happens?
Oh, I think that's one of the reasons you have to be extremely careful when using confidential sources, particularly when it gets outside the realm of fact. When it gets into opinion and people's speculation, then I think confidential sources hold up a kind of red flag, and as a reporter, you really got to watch what you write. In the Wen-Ho-Li case, I think you also have to understand this was not a case in which misinformation was given out. There was an investigation of Wen-Ho-Li. There were allegations of espionage. He was indicted. He was arrested. He was mishandled, and I think very unfairly put in solitary confinement for 9 months. There was a fear on the part of, overextended fear on the part of the government, and a lot of publicity given to the case because it had a political overtone to it. The Republicans were accusing the Clinton administration of being weak on the Chinese in an alleged espionage case because they were trying to get a better deal in terms of trade. So it had a political implication to it, and there were things said about him. But I think what's important about the Wen-Ho-Li case and the precedent is that he's not suing the government or suing the press for libel. What he's doing is saying information that the government had obtained was a violation of the Privacy Act. He has not said the information that was printed was wrong.
Do you think, Walter Pincus, user of anonymous sources, that there ought to be a federal shield law of the sort that is being discussed now in the Congress?
Well, I think shield laws are a double-edged sword for reporters because in most cases they protect the source. as well as a reporter. And I think one of the things I've been very strong about is this concept that confidential information has to be checked and double-checked before it's printed. So you've got to be careful about what you print. And shield laws on the state level have been useful because they do sort of prevent people who are suing other people from using reporters as a primary and initial tool to solve their cases. On the other hand, I think when it gets into federal court, I think you have to be careful because there clearly has to be a national security proviso in it. The Congress is going to put it in. And once you go to the Congress and ask them to start providing legislation to help journalists, I think it's a very dangerous line in sort of my mind that you're looking for protection from people you're supposed to be writing about.
Walter Pincus, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Get back to you and to Rachel Smolkin of the American Journalism Review as we go forward. But there is now, before the Congress, a proposal, a bipartisan proposal, Republican and Democratic senators are behind it, for what is called the Free Flow of Information Act. One of those who testified in favor of that before Congress is the managing editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Ann Gordon. And Ann Gordon, welcome to our program. Tell us why you think we need a shield law and what it would do and how it would take care of the issue just mentioned by Walter Pincus at the federal level with national security.
Well, let me give you a clear example. Right now, there's 31 states that have a shield law on the books. Pennsylvania happens to be one of those. That shield law is absolute, which means that confidential sources are protected under all circumstances. Thus, there is a clear certainty that the promise of confidentiality that would develop between a source and a reporter is protected and can't be compelled by a prosecutor. And that privilege applies to anyone who's employed by a newspaper, press association, television, and so on. But because the Pennsylvania law is absolute, it allows reporters and sources to have expectations that are very firmly set. There's a protection, there's a promise, everyone understands it. But the lack of a federal shield law, in effect, destroys the certainty and undermines the, in this case, right-minded policy of the Pennsylvania legislator. So that basically, without the federal shield law, a source cannot be confident that his or her identity will be protected, in this case, as the state law contemplates. So there's another very good reason to do that, is that you have federal law, which is in effect undermining state law in this particular situation. And when you are a reporter, you are starting out breaking a story. You have no idea where this story will usually take you in terms of issues that might later develop. Will you be in state court? Will you be in federal court? The added publicity of the Valerie Plame case, certainly Judith Miller's involvement in that, has indeed put a sense out there that there is no such thing as confidentiality, and that what does it really mean? What does a promise really mean? So I do think that there is some clarity that this legislation can clearly put into this situation. I certainly would happen to disagree with Mr. Pincus. I don't think that it is a question of undermining a reporter and undermining the reporting process. If anything, I think the new prosecutorial zeal to go after reporters is a dangerous thing, and that in the end, given the important function of sources, that identities do need to be given the highest protection, not reporters. The sources need to be given the highest protection, and that's the most important thing that can happen here.
We're going to a break. In one word, are you saying that the federal shield ought, like the Pennsylvania one, to be absolute?
I am willing to, and I think it's a good addition to have the national security clause placed, that there would be, you can imagine in this world that there would be needs.
Ann Gordon, managing editor of Philadelphia Inquirer. We're going to continue this conversation, as I said, on Reporter's Notebook a bit later on the fourth anniversary of the prison for suspected terrorists at Guantanamo Bay. Continuing controversy there. We'll be talking about that on To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about what's been called on this program and elsewhere an assault in the courts on the confidential sources used by many reporters. We're focusing now on the Free Flow of Information Act proposed by Republican Republican Senator Lugar of Indiana and Democratic Senator Dodd of Connecticut. I want to introduce a new guest, Henry Mark Holzer, who's professor emeritus at the Brooklyn Law School, author of a forthcoming book, Keeper of the Flame, the Supreme Court Jurisprudence of Justice Clarence Thomas. Professor Holzer, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
What do you say to the idea of a shield law of the sort we just heard described by Ann Gordon, absolute except for the issue of national security at the federal level?
Well, it's you have to distinguish what we're talking about here. Are we talking about an is or an ought? I mean, clearly the law as it stands now constitutionally is that there's no protection, and Brandsburg v. Hayes made that very clear in 72. The answer to your question is really a policy question. Congress, within its powers, can legislate on whatever it likes. The question is whether it's a good idea or not. I think it's a bad idea. I think it's a bad idea on the state level as well, because too often both journalists and sources are covering up crimes. I mean, as you may know, I wrote a piece the other day which is entitled Indict the New York Times. There's very serious questions here about violation of the Espionage Act. I'm not even sure whether a federal shield law, even if one were enacted, and even if it were, quote, absolute, quote, could protect people as against allegations of the commission of a crime.
And this has to do with the story about the National Security Agency not getting warrants for wiretaps on American citizens.
Well, yeah, that's the issue. I mean, you can phrase it that way. You can also phrase it as the New York Times reported a story which dealt with classified information and which very well may have violated the Espionage Act. I mean, people don't like to talk about that because somehow the press is supposed to be sacrosanct. But I'm waiting for somebody to tell me why the press is special.
Henry Mark Holzer at Brooklyn Law School. Back to Ann Gordon, managing editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. How do you respond to the issue just raised by the professor?
Well, in 2 points. One, the press has never claimed it's special. I think what we have claimed is that the role the press plays in this nation is indeed a special one and is, in fact, perhaps one of our highest callings. I think one of the things that needs to be made very clear here is that shield laws have been in place in this country for many, many years without jeopardizing the security of the nation in any way. In fact, I can't think of a single case where the disclosure of a confidential source would have protected citizens of this state or this nation. So I have to challenge the premise in this, and what I actually think is the higher calling here is that disclosure of a confidential source in this case would indeed jeopardize the public interest and security, because people who are concerned about the outcome of whatever the situation might be would fear for their own safety, protection, and well-being, and then they might be afraid to bring information to light. And that, in fact, is the higher value.
So with regard then to the example cited by the professor, you're saying that it is less important that the New York Times may have violated the Espionage Act by revealing classified information than it is that the New York Times decided on its own, presumably, that people needed to know the information.
Well, I don't know the inside workings of the New York Times decision-making, but...
But isn't that the opposition you're setting up?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it is more important. The information that's come out is very important and worthy of confirmation. But remember, it's not just the Times who thinks that or Ann Gordon who thinks that. It's also the people who leaked this information. As Mr. Pink has pointed out, they're the ones who made the violation in this particular case. This is a publication of the information.
Back to Professor Holzer, Professor Emeritus at Brooklyn Law School.
Just
what do you say to that?
Listen, you got 4-1 here, and I'd like an opportunity to be heard and to break this.
That's exactly why I've come back to you.
Well, it's a little late. I'd like to know the derivation or the root of this higher calling, and I'd like to know why the press is in a special position. Nobody's told me that. Constitutionally, that isn't the case. The fact that there may be shield laws does not bear on this issue at all.
Okay.
The question is this. Wait, let me finish.
Sure, go ahead.
The question is this. The Espionage Act may have been violated by what the New York Times did. So why shouldn't the New York Times be required to reveal the source of the information? And the answer of that it's a higher calling or the First Amendment has a preferred position is no answer at all. You're hearing from people on this show who have a very, very much of a vested interest in the kind of shield laws and the privilege that we're talking about, and they always invoke these bromides and these cliches about the public's right to know what, when, why. I'd just like an answer to that.
Let me go back to Walter Pincus, again, National Security reporter for The Washington Post. I don't know that you are all that much in favor of a federal shield law, but go ahead and respond, if you will, to what the professor has asked.
Well, I think there are two things. One is there's nothing in the Constitution about executive privilege. There's nothing in the Constitution about attorney-client privilege. These are common law privileges that have developed over the years to protect certain things being done. There is a First Amendment. There was a recognition in the Constitution that the free press does play an important role constitutionally, and even in Brandsburg, there's a recognition. So that I don't think you can just cast this aside. Are we different? I happen to think we're not different, but we carry on a profession, or at least hopefully we carry on a profession, that deserves a certain kind of protection. One of the things I'm much more in favor of a common law privilege, it's what we're arguing in the Wendell Lee case, and not particularly a law. But there is no law for attorney-client. There is no law for executive privilege. So I think the professor has to pause at that level.
Well, there is a law with regard to the Espionage Act, though, and if, in fact, the New York Times had violated it, shouldn't they have to give information about it?
Well,
or if they abetted in the violation of it?
Yeah, I think the closest thing you can come to is in abetting. And the fact is, in the Espionage Act, there is a provision. No provision covers publication of information. It is acceptance of information you're not entitled to, which may be a stretch. And that's why there's been no prosecution of any publication for publishing things that they were given, except in one case. And in that case, the person who got the information was a reservist and got it in his role as a reservist. So you have to stay away from that. The law doesn't say that.
Okay. Walter Pincus, again, national security reporter for The Washington Post, also a graduate of Georgetown University Law School. Back to Professor Holzer at the Brooklyn Law School. What about this issue, that it's really only abetting that the press is involved in here, and that's different from violating the law itself?
Well, in the first place, we've been talking about the culpability of the sources. In the second place, the 18 U.S.C. 793, which is the Espionage Act provision at issue here, has an explicit provision for conspiracy, as indeed Section 371 is a standalone conspiracy provision in the U.S. Code. So the newspaper is not immunized in any sense from culpability in whatever crime may have been committed here. And again, there is this feeling among the media and among the press that they are somehow above the law, and they aren't. And Mr. Pincus, as a lawyer, should know that. I mean, he alludes to the First Amendment is important. Sure, the Fourth Amendment's important. The Fifth Amendment's important. They're all important. No Supreme Court decision, indeed no Supreme Court justice in an opinion, has ever held or said, for that matter, that the First Amendment occupies a, quote, preferred position, quote. It's the academics that have floated that idea for years, and it has no constitutional validity at all. There is no justification, constitutional or otherwise, for the press to protect criminals. It's as simple as that, and that's what White said in Brandsburg.
Again, Brandsburg, the decision in 1972 where the U.S. Supreme Court said there is no special protection for confidential sources or for the reporters that use them. I'm going to get back to our reporters, but before I do, we do have another lawyer on the program who wants to address this issue from a different point of view, and that is the Privacy Act. Mark Granis is a litigator and partner with a Washington law firm, and he's done work on behalf of plaintiffs with Privacy Act litigation, such as that involved in the Wendell Lee case, which we heard about a moment ago. Mark Granis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
What do you think about the idea of a shield law of the sort we're talking about?
Well, I think that there should not be a federal shield law. The existing law on this matter is that judges decide, and I think judges should continue to decide. As for the particular shield law that Congress considered, I think that's a particularly bad one. It's based on who is a reporter. And if you're a reporter, you can't be compelled to testify about anything, including the traffic accident that you witnessed on the way to work. It's not tied to news gathering activities. it's not tied to only confidential information. And, you know, putting a national security exception on it doesn't change that. It doesn't cover cases like, say, the Privacy Act, which is also, you know, contains very important public policies. It's basically a red cape and blue tights theory of law under which some people are just special and they just don't have the same obligations to give evidence in court that the rest of us have.
What's the damage that is likely to be done if there's a shield law?
The damage is that while the reporters like to talk about this issue as if it's a whistleblower issue, as if it raises questions about the foundations of the republic, the actual facts in which most of these issues arise are that the two most powerful institutions in American society actually collude. You know, that the argument that reporters have to conceal the names of their sources so that they can be effective watchdogs against abuse by government officials is fine so far as it goes, and sometimes it actually works out that way in the real world. But unfortunately, it's often the case that the government officials use the press to commit abuses, where agencies actually set up interviews and have what journalists acknowledge are called official leaks. This is where the press office of an institution may say, yeah, you can have an interview with so-and-so, and he'll tell you all about this on condition that you not reveal that the information came from the agency. These are not whistleblowers. These are not people who are exposing corruption in government or exposing wrongdoing or mismanagement or waste or fraud. They're people who are sent out there by the government itself to get the government's message out in a way that does not allow for accountability. It does not allow for the reporters to dig and follow up and do serious questioning. It's essentially just the press not being a watchdog, but a lapdog.
Mark Grannis, a lawyer in Washington. Back to Ann Gordon, managing editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. A couple of questions. What about that practice just described, official leaking? Should the press go along with that?
No, I don't think the press should go along with that at all. And I think part of the problem...
You don't do that in your paper?
No, in fact, we have had seminars, we have official policies, we've had a story in the paper just this week that was an example of that. We do not allow our reporters to attend official off-the-record sessions. We find them to be just as egregious as your last person has said.
Well, what then about the other issue he raised, that under the Free Flow of Information Act, if it were to be passed, anybody who is a reporter, he says, would be immune from testifying even about the automobile accident he saw on the way into work?
Well, I think that's a red herring. I think that the reality of it, what we're talking about here, is these two points are really, you can be taken together. The debate over the federal shield law, I think it's been really warped by the cycle of political leaks in Washington and about the boogeyman of when and exactly when a reporter will be able to discuss a source and when he or she will not. But the reality is that these sorts of confidential discussions are a minor part of a much larger field of reporting that uses confidential sources. And as Mr. Pincus said early on in the story, it's very important to note that often the confidential source is just it's just a starting point in an investigation, but without a promise at the onset, often a fuller story won't be told. So I think that that's what makes it a very important aspect of it. But the reality of it really needs to be focused in on what happens in the day-to-day majority of America's newsrooms today and how confidential sources are used and how they are not used.
What about the issue of what Mark Grannis described as the two most powerful institutions in the country colluding to damage somebody?
I think every reporter will say to you that they honestly are aware that when they are being used and when they are not being used, and acknowledge that that happens regularly. But again, a source is just the beginning of an investigation. There's other corroborating evidence that has to be gathered. There's other confirmations that has to happen. I can't think of cases where it comes straight from the government's mouth into the newspaper other than as statements that would match up to the reality that he's trying to stretch out. There is an entire reporting process that is in place that has checks and balances on this happening. Now, does that mean to say American newspapers and reporters have not been used in the past? Absolutely not. I would never say that. Of course that's the case. But there are systems in place to try to make this happen, to try to make sure this doesn't happen.
Okay. Mark Grannis, let me go back to you, our lawyer in Washington, concerned about the Privacy Act. Those were your issues. How do you respond to what was said?
Well, I think if there is a problem with federal law not encouraging enough exposure of wrongdoing, if that's really what we're talking about here, there are other ways to deal with it. There is a Federal Whistleblower Protection Act. Congress has said that there are some leaks, some disclosures of government information that ought to be protected and encouraged. Congress has also said at the same time that there are other leaks of information that ought to be prohibited and punished criminally if necessary. That's the Privacy Act. Congress, in other words, does not buy the unstated assumption of the journalists that a leak is a leak is a leak, and that it's impossible to tell the good ones from the bad ones. If our Whistleblower Protection Act is not strong enough and doesn't provide enough protection to people who feel like they have to get a story out and do something in the public interest, why don't we strengthen the law? Why don't we strengthen the Whistleblower Protection Act instead of saying that reporters are above the law? Because ultimately, you know, this shouldn't be about what's good journalism. Ultimately, the reporter should have the final say about what he or she publishes. That's not what courts should be involved in. But you have to distinguish between the journalist's private promise and what happens when there's a legal dispute. If a reporter wants to put information out there and he tells his source, hey, I won't mention your name, that's between the journalist and the source. It's between the journalist and his editors, between the journalist and the public, and maybe between the journalist and his conscience. But it has nothing to do with a court. When a legal dispute arises, courts decide what questions have to be answered in courts of law.
Okay.
That's the obligation all of us have.
So, Walter Pincus, are you arguing that reporters are above the law and their sources?
No, I've never argued that, and that's one of the reasons why I fear a shield law. I mean, one of the bad practices I've always felt is that there's been a habit over the years for reporters and newspapers to move to quash subpoenas when they're first delivered without really knowing what the questions are, just on that basis. And I think that's allowed lawyers to make the issue that we try to stand above the law.
So you're not arguing for a shield law?
I'm not arguing strongly. I think there is another side to the lawyer part, and that is lawyers file suits and then immediately go to the press to have them do the investigative work for them by disclosing sources right off the bat without doing the work they should do in the first place. The federal government recognizes that that's a danger. And in the federal government, they won't serve subpoenas until the persons involved have exhausted all other possible sources for the information.
All right. Very few seconds left. Let me go back to our very first guest, Rachel Smolkin, the managing editor of the American Journalism Review. You said at the outset there's a dispute not just between the press and others, but also within the press, the media themselves. Elaborate a little bit on that based on what we just heard from Walter Pincus and Ann Gordon.
Well, I think some very important points were raised by both. There is a problem of using anonymous sources without checking out the information as well as we should, and there are times when we simply cannot verify the information. Look at the WMD reporting, the Weapons of Mass Destruction reporting that appeared in the New York Times and to a lesser degree in the Washington Post before the Iraq War started. I mean, we were all led to believe, in part based on the reporting, that there were weapons of mass destruction that were going to be found. So this is an area where we in the press need to do as much as we can to crack down on anonymous sources to verify the information to the extent we can. In the case of the WMDs, that's very difficult to do. But to make sure that we're not simply mouthing what the government officials tell us. So that is an important issue. However, to come back and say that, well, then we shouldn't use anonymous sources or reporters should give up their sources is a dangerous stance to take. There's very important reporting that's been done based on anonymous sources.
Okay.
I did some reporting for our October-November issue asking some reporters if they'd seen any impact from some of these investigations that are going on, and several told me they had. Rebecca Carr, who covers government secrecy for Cox Newspapers, said that she had an FBI source who was nervous about talking to her and said, I'm just very nervous about turning over information because I'm worried I'll be outed and they'll find out who I am. And this is a source that she had talked to over a period of some years. It wasn't someone that she called out of the blue.
All right. A lot of issues involved once again. At the moment, there will be attention in Congress on the Free Flow of Information Act now being considered by the Senate. We'll try to keep track of that. Thank you all for being with us. Rachel Smolkin, the editor of the American Journalism Review, Walter Pincus of the Washington Post, Ann Gordon at the Philadelphia Inquirer, Henry Mark Holzer of Brooklyn Law School, emeritus. Hope you don't still feel outnumbered. Mark Grannis, partner of a Washington law law firm dealing with Privacy Act litigation. Thanks again to all of you for being with us. This is the fourth anniversary of the detention facility set up for Tamarba suspects at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Some 500 prisoners are being held there, many of them for years without charges. There are calls to shut the facility down for humanitarian reasons. We'll have more on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're on back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Any news on Reporter's Notebook today? It is the fourth anniversary of the institution at Guantanamo Bay, where suspected terrorists are being held, a subject of interest to Amnesty International, to Germany's new chancellor, Angela Merkel, and to Mary Ellen O'Connell, who's a professor of international law at the University of Notre Dame Law School. Welcome, as always, to our program.
Thanks, Warren. It's good to be here.
What's the latest on Guantanamo Bay? Let's look at it first from an international perspective. Ms. Merkel has said that she's going to tell President Bush when she gets here on Friday that there are different ways that ought to be found to deal with prisoners. What's she talking about?
Well, she's absolutely right to make that point to President Bush. There are other ways of dealing with prisoners than is being done at Guantanamo Bay, where there are serious violations of international human rights law existing at that site.
How do you know that?
We know it from certainly from reporters, as you have just reviewed. They are a very important source of our information, but we also have information from FBI agents who observed what was going on at Guantanamo Bay. That's one of our most important sources. We also have sources from the International Committee of the Red Cross, an independent and very expert group that have reported consistently over the 4 years Guantanamo has been open about international law violations.
Amnesty International, the human rights group, is reporting today that torture continues at Guantanamo Bay. Are you satisfied that that's correct?
We have enough past information about the use of torture and abuse at Guantanamo Bay that I would find reports by Amnesty International to be highly credible.
So what about the tribunals, then, that we began today? There are two of them, military tribunals. There's been a lot of controversy about them and their ability to deliver a fair trial. What's the argument?
Well, the argument that they will not deliver a fair trial is that these tribunals as set up are not consistent with the requirements for a fair trial as established in particular, the Geneva Conventions, which should be the international laws governing how people are held at Guantanamo Bay. And those require a fair and standard trial process of any persons who are being held in military detention for trials. The Geneva Conventions, for example, require that a person have a defense counsel of their choice, and that is certainly not the case at Guantanamo Bay. Most importantly, we don't have independent judges on those military tribunals, and individuals are not allowed to confront witnesses or the evidence against them, all serious problems of due process.
Serious problems of due process, but those who favor them say that they are necessary in a time of war against non-combatants, people who don't work for any particular state or fight in uniform, but who are bent on destruction and the deprivation of other people's human rights. Is there any argument in behalf of making changes, making compromises for these kinds of cases?
No, I don't. I really don't see an argument for making compromises in these cases. Compromising the rule of law is an argument for the end, justifying the means. We should be our struggle against terrorism should be a struggle to support the rule of law, because terrorists are supposed to be the ones who are damaging the rule of law, who stand against it, and are the law violators. We should distance ourselves from them by being the champions of the law and complying strictly with all of our legal obligations.
Again, we're talking with Mary Ellen O'Connell, professor of international law at the University of Notre Dame Law School. What about the much publicized change in the law advocated by Senator McCain of Arizona, which the president said he signed with a pleasure? Didn't that deal with this question of torture at Guantanamo Bay and other places once and for all?
Well, that was the great hope of many of us. It was a very laudable initiative by Senator McCain and other supporters of the bill, very widely supported throughout our Congress. But very sadly, Warren, when the president signed the bill that contained McCain's amendments with a simple ban on cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, he attached a statement that said that he would reserve the right to exercise his authority as commander-in-chief and the head of the unitary executive. And these are code words for saying that he reserves the right to override the statute if he believes or he's given reason or arguments that he should permit a cruel, inhuman, or degrading technique of interrogation.
Of course, he has denied, the whole administration has denied, that they are, in fact, engaged in torture. So is the definition of that term one of the issues that has to be dealt with?
It really shouldn't have to be dealt with. We have plenty of very solid legal interpretation, case law, and so forth that explains to us both what torture is and, more importantly, the broader category of techniques of interrogation that are cruel, inhuman, degrading, or unlawfully coercive. We don't allow our police, Warren, to use coercive methods, and the U.S. Army has had a consistent 30, 35-year practice of not using coercive techniques of interrogation. Their techniques have been, until now, consistent with the Geneva Conventions. We've done very well in defending our country against incredible foes like the Soviet Union using those techniques. That's what we should be doing. That's what Senator McCain wanted us to do. But somehow the president has been persuaded, or probably more the vice president, that cruel methods of interrogation are useful to this country, and they simply are not.
Marianne O'Connell, University of Notre Dame Law School, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Today's program produced by Andrea Brody with Jonah King and Karen Radziner. Thanks to Technical Director Mike Newport. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.